Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
My first guest today, not a million miles away from what we were just talking about there, Dr. Suzanne Crowe, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan. Thanks for inviting me here.
Suzanne, you're president of the Irish Medical Council, but more importantly, you're a consultant in paediatric intensive care. And you've written a book called Intensive Care, and it's your story to an extent, but it's also the stories of some of the many critically ill children who have come into your life and their parents. And of course, you yourself then became one of those parents suffering a devastating tragedy. The book is, you know, it's terribly sad, but it is life-affirming too. We learn a lot from these children and their parents in their book, but it is a deeply moving book. I would challenge anyone to read it without crying probably several times. You and your colleagues cry a lot too, do you? You're not immune.
We do. We cry a lot and we comfort each other a lot because nobody gets the experience as much as the people that you work alongside with.
They're really the only ones who understand it, are they?
There's huge strength to be gained from actually supporting each other. There are external supports as well, but I have found over the years, and I think a lot of my colleagues have, that actually just listening to each other's stories is the best way of helping each other.
You nearly left medicine after one of your patients died, didn't you?
I did, and I suppose there's a few times that I've tried to escape the medicine thing, but I found the impact of the loss of a child when I was very early on in my training just almost too much to bear. Bearing in mind that this was going back a couple of decades ago, where we didn't talk about these things as much, and there certainly wasn't support out there. We were just expected to get on with it, and I just couldn't get on with it.
Do you have to learn to not bring it home? I know you stopped telling your late husband about work at one stage, didn't you?
I did. You learn how to, I suppose, dose yourself with some of the difficult things that you encounter. Some of it you can bring home, and certainly some of the lovely stories I would bring home and tell my children and tell my husband. But some of the more difficult, traumatic losses and experiences, it just wasn't possible to bring home because they're innocent creatures living their lives. They didn't sign up for this. They didn't choose it. And so I always felt I had a responsibility to protect them from some of these really awful things.
So there are good days too, though, yeah, where miracles happen.
There are wonderful days. The mortality in intensive care for children is actually very low. It's less than 3% at this stage. It was higher 20, 30 years ago, but we've made huge progress. So the vast majority of children may have very difficult experiences in intensive care, and it is terrifying for parents, but most of them will do well and go home.
Do you also go over things afterwards?
Yes, endlessly. I think everybody who works in healthcare does. You second guess yourself a lot and question whether you did the right thing, whether you could have done better, done more, even sometimes maybe done less. So I think that internal dialogue in your head in terms of asking yourself whether you've done the right thing, that just never stops. And I think it's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. So the people coming to you, right, they're in a nightmare situation, and presumably sometimes you don't know if that child is going to live or die, or if they do live, how better they will get, all of that. How do you manage the expectations of parents around that?
Generally by being very honest and choosing your words very carefully and allowing plenty of space to listen to what they expect is going to happen, because people come with different knowledge, different views and different expectations. So sometimes just stopping and saying, where do you think your child is at the moment and what do you think is going on, can really help in managing the next steps. And then
why?
Because people come and they often think that perhaps their child is automatically going to get better, and they have perhaps a very unrealistic view of what's ahead. And if you don't hear that, you won't be able to manage it. So, or the opposite, a set of parents may say to you, this is absolutely hopeless, isn't it? And luckily you're able to step in and say, no, actually, there's a lot of hope here. There's a lot of good reasons to be hopeful. So I think understanding where parents are at the start helps guide you. And then also choosing your words carefully so that you can, I suppose, speak to the likelihood of a good outcome, but also set down a marker that there is possibility that maybe the outcome will not be good.
So then if you have to tell parents their child is going to die, you have a phrase in the book, the end of hope is devastating. How do you even approach a conversation like that?
You learn a lot, and we do teach our trainees how to do that. But to be honest, you really learn as you go along, and you learn, you make mistakes. You sometimes say too much. You sometimes say too little. I have learned, and I speak about this in the book, Intensive Care, how I have made the mistake of actually thinking I was doing the correct thing by taking away all hope so that a message would be really clear. And in fact, that being the wrong thing to do.
What was it you said?
I said that there was no hope at all. There was absolutely no prospect of recovery and that their child would die. And it completely fractured the relationship that I had with those parents. I could see that they just absolutely closed a door on me. And in fact, I remember very clearly the father of the child never looked me in the eye again. And I knew why. It's because I had taken away all hope. It's the cruelest thing to do.
Even if there is no hope.
Even if there is no hope.
Yeah.
Yes, you must leave open a door to hope. It's incredibly important. And that's why, even though in the book I talk about a lot of really traumatic and distressing things, there is always hope. And I think the dignity and the respect for children that I speak about actually really gives a lot of hope.
So do parents get angry with you sometimes?
Yes.
As the bearer of the bad news, yeah?
Yes, they do, yeah. And you do learn to manage that. It's probably the most difficult reaction to learn how to manage. You would expect that people will get really distressed and cry and perhaps be, you know, incoherent with sorrow. But anger is a difficult one because you have to obviously learn how to diffuse it safely, keep the staff safe. And generally what I have learned to do is it's best to just sit and listen as long as it's safe to do so, and then just bring the conversation to an end and allow a little bit of time and come back to it, and offer for people to bring in additional support as well. That's absolutely vital. You can't have these conversations on your own, and no parent should be on their own for these conversations either.
One thing that I found really touching in the book is that once you can't do anything more for a child, you then focus on how to make the death as good as it can be. Tell me a bit about that.
I think I've learned most about that from working with nurses in intensive care over the years, both in adult intensive care and in children's intensive care. The nurses are absolutely amazing at bringing about a good death. And we have parties on intensive care when a child is dying. And I know that sounds like the most bizarre thing that your listeners have probably heard. But what it means is that we actually put down our tools of fixing people, as it were, and we turn our emphasis onto really bringing out the person, the personality of the child, the personality of the family, and making memories. Because for some of our families, it may be a baby, so they may have almost no memories of the baby being at home, or the baby, you know, hasn't grown up or gone to school. So there's that loss of potential and loss of memories. We try to make up for it in some way and to do things on the unit that can help the parents take away a sense of, well, this was our story with our child.
Yeah, you mentioned a thing called, is it called a last night?
Yes.
Celebration that can happen in a room. Just paint a picture of what that might look like.
Well, I think I did describe one particular night when there was a lot of Damien Rice playing very loudly. And you know, there can be great joy when a family has come to the acceptance that their child is going to die, which is a dreadful step to have to take. But when they have come to that point, there can be celebration of the child's life. And we open the doors and allow as much family and friend visiting as we possibly can, as discreetly as we can, obviously.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just allow the family to direct things themselves. So if they want balloons or music, if they want to make recordings, take photographs, make videos, whatever it is, I think the nurses are as open-minded and have seen everything that we possibly okay. could see. We've even had a sneaky dog visit, but don't tell anyone.
And then sometimes it can be more challenging. So I think you would very firmly say that a parent has a right to be there at the end of their child's life, even if that is a very distressing scene and even if you might be working on a child. Just describe that to me.
That's, I suppose, something I've changed my view on over the years. The traditional medical teaching was that we would have actually escorted a family out when we were trying to resuscitate somebody. But in paediatrics, in children's medicine, it's a bit different. And we really do believe that parents should be there if they wish to be, but they also should be offered the opportunity to be there when their child is dying, because the chances of resuscitating a person are actually quite slim, particularly when somebody is in intensive care, because they're already on maximum treatment. So during resuscitation, there's very little else to add in. And so, unfortunately, the chance that death will happen during those minutes is very high. And so I am very keen that parents will stay during that time and be present, because these are the kind of things that a parent is going to think about every day for the rest of their life. I'm not going to think about it. I have my own life. But this is what a parent is going to think about when they open their eyes in the morning, is those last moments and how it is better to spend them with your child.
Even if there are distressing things and an atmosphere of maybe urgency around it and people doing things and all of that, the parent is what, just sitting there quietly holding the child's hand in the middle of all that?
It's very possible. And mostly, I think parents are grateful that, firstly, they were there, and secondly, that they can see how much we care and how much effort is going into actually trying to bring their child back. They can see that. It's very difficult to explain that to somebody afterwards if they're outside the room. But this is a non-verbal thing. You can see how much the staff are putting into trying to bring the child back.
Is it hard to stop intervening with a child?
It is hard, yes. The whole emphasis in healthcare and medicine is to cure, to treat, to prolong life. And it is difficult to acknowledge when it is time to stop.
So presumably you've been in situations where you have thought afterwards, we did too much there. You mentioned the burdens versus the benefit of interventions.
Not many, many times, but okay. There have been times with some children that I have questioned whether we went a little bit too far. But in a way, that's a conversation that you have in your head when you now know what has happened. It's very difficult to see forwards. It's always easier to see backwards.
You say you became better at that once you came to accept the end of life.
I did, yeah. I think I probably was always operating at the level of, you know, being a doctor and trying to be the best doctor I could and placing huge emphasis on keeping life going. But when I went through my own personal experience of loss, I think it made me see that there is a greater importance at times to accepting the end of life and actually, you know, allowing space for that so you could get the most out of that, get the most meaning out of that period.
So tell me about your Beatrice.
My little daughter, yes, my fourth child, who I have not spoken about very much before. It took me a long time before I was able to speak about her, but she really is the kernel in this book.
So you were in France, you were pregnant. What happened?
It was a difficult pregnancy, and I suppose myself and my husband had come around to the idea that this little lady was definitely going to make her presence felt in our lives. And so we went on holidays with the children, and unfortunately I went into labour at 23 weeks, and Beatrice was born in hospital in France. And we stayed there. She stayed in the neonatal intensive care unit in a very big hospital in Nice. And she lived for 19 days. And that was a really difficult experience.
It sounds like the French medical people were, like, some of them bordering on cruel at times.
I think it's, I don't think they were cruel. I think what I came to see was there are huge cultural differences in how we deliver care, and it is very different to be a patient in another country. There's a different approach, and then you have the language difference as well. I probably picked up some things as being quite harsh, when in fact, if they were translated correctly and not in my rubbish French, they wouldn't have seemed so harsh.
But you were bringing in breast milk every day to the hospital when Beatrice was in there, and what happened there?
Yes, the French word jeter, to throw out. So they were throwing out my breast milk, and they were a little bit mystified as to why I was bringing it in. And that was because I was doing what we did in the neonatal intensive carers in Ireland, which was we bring in our breast milk and we preserve it for later, for when the baby is ready to feed. And that's just not what was happening in neonatal care in France at that time.
Yeah, but they were quite direct about it, weren't they?
They were quite direct, yeah.
Two important moments in Beatrice's life and death. You held Beatrice as she died, and that was and remains a hugely important thing for you, doesn't it?
It does. And even as you say that, I can immediately summon that back into my head. Yeah, I can. I mean, I can immediately see myself holding her, and it is the most wonderful thing, and I'm so grateful to have done so.
Yeah. And then, tell me about the next day.
The next day, there was a lot kind of happened in a bit of a blur. And for anybody who's lost somebody, there's massive dropouts in your memory as you blur things. But the next day we had to go and visit her and identify her in the mortuary. I'm not entirely sure why that was, but so we went to visit her in the mortuary, which was a really, really distressing experience. And, you know, when I look...
Why was it?
It was so cold and it was so senseless, and it kind of confirmed everything that I thought that I'd misunderstood about the entire experience.
What do you mean?
She very clearly, she looked completely different, as people do after death. She was wearing kind of ridiculously huge kind of baby clothes, and she looked like a dead premature baby. And I think I saw that for the first time, as in, how could I ever have been thinking that she was going to live? And where, you know, how could I have been optimistic and hopeful and making plans to bring her back to the neonatal unit in Dublin? I really felt like it was everything that I had thought had been completely robbed and was incorrect. And it just emptied my heart and my head completely, the sight of her like that. And I really, really regretted seeing her like that. It really changed, and it really impacted on my ability to grieve in a healthy way after.
Yeah. So your grief was very, very acute, wasn't it? You say you no longer knew who you were. You were almost disappearing. Part of it was, and this was not justified in any way, but part of it was, it started with a sense of guilt after that day, did it?
Well, the guilt had started earlier, because to be fair, and to be honest, I hadn't really wanted to be pregnant. And that there's some good reasons that I go into in the book about that. But this was not a pregnancy that I had gone into intentionally. And so I regretted then later those feelings, because I just bet myself up saying, well, you know, you've no right to be sad and you've no right to grieve, because you didn't really want her anyway. So I was carrying a lot of guilt throughout the pregnancy as it was. And then when the death was so distressing and difficult, it meant that it really made me question whether I would ever recover, and also whether I even had any right to recover from the whole experience.
Your husband was grieving in his own way. Is that just how it is in a situation like that, that two people have to go on their own separate personal journeys of grief, and that hopefully they come back, they intersect again at the end rather than go further apart?
Grieving as a couple is really, really difficult. It puts enormous stress on a relationship. You know, men and women are different in many different ways. And one of the things that men and women do differently is grieving the loss of a child. And even though I actually did know that on a kind of an intellectual level, because I had seen it at the bed space in the intensive care unit, I then experienced it. Now, I was able to say to my husband that this was quite likely to happen and that we should really kind of pull together and acknowledge that. But even still, we did still head off in slightly different directions. He started, in a sense, looking to new experiences and new things that we could do as a family. For example, we went looking at houses. He was very keen we would move house. Whereas I was looking backwards all the time. I was looking back over the pregnancy, over the death. I was looking over family photographs. I found it difficult to bring my mind to the future. So we definitely drifted apart during that time, even though we knew that that's what was going to happen.
But Suzanne, you were drowning as well, were you?
I was. I looked great, though, but I was drowning. And so I suppose when I speak about these experiences now, it's probably quite a surprise to a lot of people who would have known me during that time, because I was actually functioning.
Oh, did you present okay? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I was functioning because, you know, I had three other children to look after. So I had to obviously get up and put my coat on in the morning. However, inside, I was really, really struggling. And I was struggling because I was trying to recover. And it was only when I actually stopped trying to recover and actually say to myself, I'm actually just going to continue my bond with this baby, with Beatrice. I'm just going to carry her with me every day into everything that I do.
Okay.
And that's how I'm going to move on with this. And it was only then that actually I started being able to, I suppose, rebuild my life.
You say Beatrice lived. She lived for 19 days and she was loved. Your other kids still talk about their sister, yeah?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, no, absolutely. We talked about her a lot, and we were very keen on doing, because I know that when you lose a child, one of the most horrendous things to contemplate is that their name will not be known and that, you know, their existence will be forgotten. So we always speak about Beatrice. She's there hanging on the Christmas tree with, she probably has more stars on the Christmas tree than the other children, but she's certainly there. And we have photographs of her tiny little hands and tiny little feet hanging on the walls as well.
So do you, when you went back into work then, is Beatrice with you then as well, in the sense of, do you have a new empathy then with the parents of your patients?
I think I had a very strong empathy always, but what it did was it really deepened my sense of purpose about how I was going to approach each child and each family, and how I was really going to lean in and in no way, you know, no way detach myself, which can be a little bit of a tendency sometimes with healthcare staff to protect yourself.
Yeah.
But I was going to do the opposite. I was going to lean on Beatrice and lean into the experiences with parents and children, because I felt that this purpose that I had from Beatrice's life and her birth and death in France would mean that I would be able to bring understanding of what it was like to parent in a different country, through a different language, through a different culture, and also what it is like in a very real sense to lose a child.
The parents you deal with, the parents of sick children, not that we want to turn them into heroes or anything, but they can be extraordinary people, can't they? Because they have to, I guess. You think that they and their children can teach us a lot, like, for example, how to live in the moment.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you watch your parents, they celebrate a lot of very small things. We have great fun. We've got great crack on the unit. Parents of sick children add a huge amount to the life of the intensive care. They also support each other hugely. And they see the humanity of the staff because they're there a lot. They can see when a nurse is really tired. They can see when somebody's upset. So I think that parents of sick children can teach us a huge amount. They also teach us actually about bigger things, the values of caring, just caring for each other, trust, compassion, justice. I think, you know, when you see what is fair and what is not fair, you can't lack an awareness of social justice when you work with sick children. Those themes are there all the time. And those themes are very deliberately in the book Intensive Care, because even though I wanted to tell my own story and the story of individual children, I also wanted to provide a kind of a very strong values-based background as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I want to talk to you about moral distress before we finish. Can I just stay with the parents for a minute? I think something a lot of us maybe observe sometimes is that having a sick child in a family can take a huge toll on a relationship, on a marriage, on a family, maybe even sometimes more so than having a child with a disability.
It can. There's a huge impact on the siblings who may be very distant. You know, lots of families travel huge distances up to hospitals, Temple Street and Crumlin, and spend weeks or months at a time. And what's happening to the siblings back home? They're often living with grandparents or aunts and uncles or neighbours. So, you know, they can become quite distant from the family, and they have their own emotions about the child who's sick. And then the parents are often travelling back and forth, may not actually spend a huge amount of time together because one is trying to be on the road on the way back down to the other kids and the other is up in Dublin. So you can see how a family becomes fractured very, very quickly. And there are supports there to help the families. But at the end of the day, nothing is just like having your child back home. That's the most important thing.
Did your work take a toll on your family and relationships as well?
It did. It definitely changed. It changed me as a person, and it really changed me as a mother.
In what way?
Well, I don't have anything to compare with because it's the only type of mother that I am. And because I was already a doctor when I had my first child. But it does mean that I suppose I don't get too stressed, or I don't worry about, you know, the smaller stuff. Although my son did lose his school jumper after 2 days of secondary school last week.
I'm sure in the moment, like, you might have lost the perspective a bit.
I think you see the bigger picture, and I really dig in and celebrate each day. So, you know, we have a lot of very close moments as a family, and I'm probably a very benign and easygoing mother. That's what I think anyway.
But then you are struck by tragedy again in 2019, the sudden death of your husband, Barry. That must have been so hard after everything you'd been through already, and so hard anyway.
It was an absolute bolt from, it was dreadful. Again, my priority was just always very much my kids. I'm trying to just kind of dig in and make sure that they were okay.
So, and how are they doing?
They're doing good. Good days and bad, up and down. It's always there. So I think that's the thing about loss and grief. It's there every day. But we actually get on very well, and we're very close as a result of the experience. We talk about my husband a lot, as we do my daughter. And we laugh a lot because there is a lot to laugh about.
OK, so, and you said the same thing about Beatrice. It's learning to live with grief, is it? Not trying to get past grief or get, you know, eventually let time do its work and cure grief. It's actually accepting the grief, inviting it in and letting it be there as a presence in your life.
Exactly, inviting it in. And actually, and I know this sounds perhaps a little strange, but it can greatly enhance your life. It can make you a far more kinder and more patient person. And there's huge strength to be drawn on what is left behind. And for me, what was left behind was my own family. And so that's where I draw the strength from. But I also draw the strength from my work and from my colleagues and my patients. So I think emphasising what's left behind after loss is really where you find yourself.
Okay. Look, we can't have this conversation without talking about the limits of the system in which your colleagues work, the circumstances that they sometimes work in. And we've heard a lot about, you know, the broader narrative around children's health is not good in Ireland at the moment. And you do touch on this notion. I had never heard of this, and it was Emily O'Connor, the emergency doctor, told me about the notion of moral distress.
Yeah, I mean, the impact of caring is enormous on the staff, and that's very clear in the book. And I was very deliberate that I wanted to show the humanity of the staff. But there's no doubt that when we don't have enough resources to do what we, not only what we would like to do, but what we also know is the right thing to do, it causes a lot of psychological distress for staff. Now, I'm certainly not trying to diminish what experiences, for, you know, what that means for parents and for children.
Of course,
the most important thing.
Yeah.
But there is a huge consequence for the staff as well.
And do people have to make decisions that they know are going to increase the likelihood of a child dying because of limited resources?
It wouldn't really come to that, but there are smaller decisions along the way that when you look back may have made a difference. For example, it could be a delay in starting treatment, or it could be a delay in being able to have an MRI scan, or a delay in transferring a child from one hospital to another for specialist care. So it can be smaller things like that, that when you look back will have had a difference. And we will have known at the time what the correct thing to do was and what the best standard of care was. But for a variety of different reasons, sometimes due to staffing or resources, we just wouldn't have been able to do it. And you carry that home. And, you know, it's okay, I suppose, to carry it home once or twice. But if you're carrying that back in your head and in your heart day after day, it becomes incredibly corrosive.
Yeah, you're going to burn out, aren't you? Yeah, yeah. And look, one thing that comes across very clearly in the book, and you're very deliberate about saying this yourself as well, that you don't treat illness, you treat people, and it's the story of those people and everything. And that, and one thing that becomes very clear in all the stories you tell is that whatever we hear on the macro about the health service, the kindness and the humanity in there from you and all your colleagues is absolutely extraordinary. I have loads of texts here, Suzanne, but I'll just read a couple. An arresting and poignant interview with Suzanne. Good for people to hear. I've worked as a nurse and midwife at the Mater, the Coombe and James's in Dublin. Someone else said, words fail me to express my admiration for your guest. And there's a lot of people, a lot of people with nice stories about the paediatric intensive care unit. I'm the grandmother of a little boy who is accessing the PICU unit in Crumlin. The ongoing care is extraordinary. The kindness, expertise and support given to our family is beyond words. We are eternally grateful. And I think that grandmother, and I hope, Granny, you get a good outcome there. But she speaks for a lot of people, also empathising with the story of little Beatrice. The book is called Intensive Care. It's published by Hachette, and it's terrific. Dr. Suzanne Crowe, thank you very much. We'll take a break.